Which kind of makes the achievement of Musk and Tesla, pretty remarkable. And that's not a normal guy. You can tell that, capital, it's a capital intensive business. Capital's been very much part of their whole story.
Welcome to Forward Looking Business, the show where ambitious and successful CEOs share their capital allocation strategies, which have enabled them to maximize the potential of their companies. With your hosts, CEO and founder Kevin Griffith and CMO Nick Lipitsky.
All right. Hi, this is the Forward Looking Podcast. This is Nick Lipitsky with Amplify. Today, Kevin Griffith, CEO of Amplify, and I are talking with Lee Schaefer, a columnist at the Star Tribune, a business columnist. We met with Lee a few weeks ago, and as we were talking about our ongoing conversations around capital allocation, Lee Schaefer brought up a certain business icon with a fantastic story. So today we're going to talk about Alfred P. Sloan, former chairman and CEO of General Motors. I believe he was there from the 1920s to 1930s. But one of the things that Sloan is credited for was what we're calling the bureaucracy for good. So that'll be the topic, and that's the title of today's podcast. What we'll do is first just kick off a brief introduction about who Sloan is. And actually, before that, we should do a quick introduction with Lee. And maybe if Lee, if you'd like to introduce yourself quickly and give us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, thanks. Happy to be here. I'm the Star Tribune business columnist. I write about business and economics here in the upper Midwest. Just passed my 8th anniversary. And I was somewhat of an experiment for the Star Tribune. They wanted somebody who could write with authority about business, having been in business. So to go to the Star Tribune, I shut down my small consultancy, having forgotten that I probably needed to grieve the closing of my business, which did bug me at the time. Somehow I didn't anticipate that. But I've been at the Star Tribune ever since. And my interests are really wide ranging. But having, again, come out of the business world, I think I do. Strongest part of my game is explaining business to a broad audience. In order to do that well, you have to talk with people in business like you know what you're talking about. So it does seem to sort of work. One foot in one world and one foot in the other.
Yeah, it's a great column.
Yeah, it is a great column. Yeah, so everybody check out Star Tribune. Yeah, Lee Schaefer. It's the thing I read first every time I get the paper. So.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, that's true too. That's the truth. Anyway, so we'll get into it. I've got Sloan's bio up here. Basically, so Sloan is credited with establishing a lot of things that we think are just very normal in the auto industry. He established the annual styling changes within General Motors, and the concept of planned obsolescence came from that. He also established this pricing structure and a brand hierarchy of sorts where you would have each brand, Chevy, Pontiac, Oldsmobile, Buick, and Cadillac, all part of this ladder. And I believe he referred to it as the ladder of success. So, that's what we're referring to as bureaucracy, a good form of bureaucracy. And I've never heard of bureaucracy painted in a positive light until Lee framed it that way. So this is a conversation that I've been excited to have for a long time. So I'll pause there and check in with Kevin to see if there's anything Kevin wants to talk about or tee up before we get into it.
I mean, you've got to be good at something to have the MIT Business School of Management, other than the donations. But I'm just reading, he's an engineer, and engineers are always fascinating the way they think. They think very differently than accountants, for example. Yeah. So this will be good.
Well, Sloan is one of the people who wrote a book. This was sort of before such things were popular. Yeah, I think it was called My Years with General Motors. And I found my copy at the Minneapolis Public Library, but I had to go back a day later because they had to go into the archives to fetch it out. So it is not at all clear to me when the last time some other person touched this book. But that was one of the source materials that I'd read. And I got interested in this because of an article about how Google was turning itself into Alphabet, where they were creating divisions with greater autonomy and clarity and their strategic focus as they evolved into a big company from something that the founders used to sort of run personally off the table. And they talked about how fads change and styles change, but what Google and Alphabet was doing is a little like what General Motors had done a century before. And that just really intrigued me. It's always better to look at history rather than try to forecast. better to be an historian than a forecaster. And so I like to look back at where some of these forms and ideas came from. And Sloan is fascinating. The part that people don't realize about the auto industry, because you know, we all grew into it when it was mature and global and that kind of stuff. When I became an adult, you know, bureaucracy of GM was horrible. There's this massive middle management structure, and it was almost a joke, right? How stifling the bureaucracy was. But you go back to the 19-teens and the 1920s, and Detroit was Silicon Valley. It was the Wild West. All sorts of crazy entrepreneurs running around. You know, the Dodge boys who ended up, you know, suing Henry Ford, and you had Ford, who was, of course, not a normal guy. And the guy running General Motors at the time, Will Durant, he was right there with him. He was a cowboy. And it was so chaotic. And the General Motors almost went out of business a couple of times. The one anecdote I really remember was how from the head office in Detroit, they had to negotiate with Buick and Flint and go over to negotiate to get money out of the Buick operation so they could pay the corporation's bills. I mean, they literally negotiate, you know, and that was just sort of indicative of how nutty it was. And Sloan wrote this memo, I think it was called the Organization Study or something like that. He wrote this long memo that became sort of the guiding principle of the company. And he was just going to end all this stuff. He was going to end the chaos. He was going to end the divisions competing with each other. He was going to end treating the checkbook irresponsibly. He was going to end all that stuff. It took him a while, but he really did succeed. Henry Ford, meanwhile, had contempt for all of it. Ford ran his place like a big mom and pop, and he was pop. And within not very long, General Motors had passed Ford in market share and then just kept going. That all took place during that era. You know, Ford had invented some pretty amazing stuff, including the production line, you know, the mass production. But he was completely overtaken by General Motors in marketing and design and in other aspects of the business, in part because of this focus that Sloan had brought to General Motors.
I think that's interesting that someone like Ford could look at or be credited with the assembly line and, you know, the thought process or the thinking around breaking something up in that way to build a car isn't, from my perspective, much different from breaking up a company into various components and then choosing to invest in them the way Sloan did. So I guess that there's no answer to this, but I think it's interesting that someone like Ford couldn't take the operational expertise that he had and apply it across other components of his business. I don't know.
Well, yeah, among other things, he just refused to change the product line. I mean, his whole business strategy was to take cost out. And that worked for a long time. You know, the old joke was you could get the Model T in any color you wanted so long as it was black. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just the same year after year. And Ford made a lot of money over that period of time. It of course, built capital intensive facilities that were amazing for the time. But that was a strategy that worked for a while, and then it needed a more sophisticated approach, and he didn't know how to do that.
You think it's a different breed that, you know, someone who's able to provide that structure, the framework, like Sloan, is very different from the innovator like Ford?
Well, that possibly is true. I mean, we've talked about that in business since I've been around, where, you know, founders give way to so-called professional management. And I don't really think of them to be as a necessary path that organizations need to go down. A founder who can be effective when there's 12 people in one room and two contractors and somewhere else can still be effective as the organization grows. Their work changes. I mean, I always talk about this as like your founder one day, the following day, you're a manager. And if you don't understand that, you probably need to get smart about it. Sloan had come up, you know, in his organization. I think he'd been one of the companies that General Motors acquired. They acquired a bunch of people. And it was an amalgamation, really, of various car companies and suppliers was how they became General Motors. So he had come up, you know, from a relatively small shop. But it just needed to be rationalized. You know, what Toyota Motor ultimately created in its Toyota production system, you know, it's basically taking the same ideas and refining them and refining them and refining them. And that's how you could run a big organization. You know, he wanted to take responsibilities away from the line managers. We wanted them to work on product. We wanted them to address the marketplace. But, you know, a lot of other stuff, we'll just take that over for you. And you competed with capital inside the organization. You know, you did not get what you asked for. Competed with capital. And that's what the organization does for you, right? Your line managers, you know, are always going to be, well, they should be anyway, optimists, They should be strategic. They should be looking for opportunities to grow their operation. But ultimately, they do compete, and they compete for the parent company's checkbook. And even people in business that I work with, the organization's got money, but they've always got alternatives for it, right? They always have alternatives for it. Mm-hmm. And so that's the organization. Just because the organization has money or can raise money doesn't mean that your alternative is an attractive one versus the other things they could do with it. And that's certainly what that's Warren Buffett's whole program, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, and I think that's fascinating too. When you kind of hit a chord with me when you were talking about the business or the founder is a founder for one day, right? And what I see a lot are, and there's a culture around this I see too, where there's this pride in being the visionary, which then creates this, seems to be this byproduct of if one labels themselves as a visionary, then they don't want to touch or they don't want to handle any operations or execution, right? Yeah. And it seems almost toxic. And, you know, maybe I'm being a little heavy-handed, but what I see are, it's a glorification of this single skill set of being a visionary. And what you're talking about and what I'm hearing, the more that I understand the practice of capital allocation, is that, you know, you can still be the visionary, but you have to understand the various components of the business well enough to know how they support that vision. And I think that's one of the things that if I were to criticize this culture of visionary glorification, but what I think is there's that missing link, right? Like there's too much bifurcation of this visionary and operator or visionary versus operator, you know, and we see that, you know, with a lot of the businesses that we work in, and sometimes it's just because it's a novice business owner or operator, but some people don't even want to get into it.
Well, I think that's one of the big hard problems of high growth companies is that things are going well, right? You have additional needs for people, you bring them in, you have to expand, you know, in a normal environment, not a COVID environment, you might look for additional office space as a 10-year lease and all of a sudden, and all of a sudden your fixed costs and your costs go up and you really don't know where your money is going. And that is something I see all the time. And to some extent, that explains the General Motors of the go-go days in the 1920s. They didn't know where the money was going. They needed controls and oversight, you know, systematically throughout the whole organization. You can be successful and still run out of money in the sense that you have customers and you have a market opportunity and you've got growing revenue. I've seen plenty of companies, you know, outrun their own checkbook. And that's what the leap that needs to happen. It's like founders go, I need to be in control of design. I need to be in control of, you know, whatever they found in the company. But boy, they need to be in control of the checkbook. They need to know that all the time. They don't need to walk around, you know, with a checking balance in their head. That's not healthy. But they need to know where the money's going and what it's producing.
Yeah. Anything to add there, Kevin? I know you feel strongly about that too.
Yeah, I mean, that's build a business around it.
Yeah, but you build. Yeah,
I mean, it's so true, right? And what do you get paid to do, right? You get paid to execute. It's hard to execute. There are a lot of dreamers, and if you think about where business started, you know, Main Street 150 years ago, you know, these are new disciplines that have been cropping up over the last 100 years. And I totally agree. I mean, if you're the CEO, you have to know where the money's going and you have to understand opportunity costs. And the more you can flesh out your opportunity costs, you're going to make better decisions. Because I think that's what a lot of people do is they look at least finance and they say, okay, we're going to make money on it. Okay, great. Go do it. And they don't even think about, well, what about the opportunity next week? What about the opportunity next month? You know, how do you build this sequentially? You know, we just went through this this month with one of our clients. They're growing really fast and there's a huge working capital build and they want to do everything right now because the market's is there. And it's like, okay, well, is the market going to be there in 3 weeks? Because in 3 weeks, my cost of capital is going to drop by 150%. Right. So what do you want me to do? Right. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting viewpoint that I don't know how many people get to.
You know, I've been involved in business and I've seen it my current perch where there are entrepreneurs in particular who they delegate the finance to somebody or something, and they need to be informed, you know, how we're doing. I mean, this is a fascinating thing. You know, the closing of the monthly books, you know, where we're going to wait 48 hours and then we're going to have the controller walk out and tell us if we made money. I mean, I've seen that a bunch of times. And that is, you know, not a healthy place for the manager to be. You've got to have process, or you've got to have a system. If the intuition is not enough and the organization's already grown of such a size that that's not possible, you have to be, you know, on top of stuff more frequently than at the end of the month when you find out if you made money. And by the way, what does made money mean? You know, our checking balance went down. And that, anyway, some of these things have been, you know, these are business processes that have been around a long time, which is the topic of this conversation. And he did that by putting somebody in charge. He did that by creating budgets, and he did that by having a process. And these were all important steps in the evolution of turning a small company into a big company.
So, Lee, when question more specifically about Sloan, I mean, you kind of look at, if I look at the General Motors model he built, one of the things that we constantly talk about is investing in activities that create value.
Right.
And this was a sophisticated system, right? Mm-hmm. With the financing right. arm, the brands, the pricing. So I guess the question is, was there any insight in the book, or do you have any to shed light on how did he figure it out?
Well, he wasn't by himself, obviously. He had a team, but the thing that needed to stop right away is interdivisional competition in the marketplace. You know, there was interdivisional competition internally, fine, but in the marketplace. And that was one of the things that had to stop. And so that was the, you know, that was wasteful. When I first got into the business, I got to then called First Bank System, now U.S. Bank. You know, if we took a deal away from First Bank Mini, we were thrilled. I mean, I knew nothing. I was 23, 24. I knew nothing, but I knew that was dumb. And, you know, our competition was out there. It wasn't here. So that was how, that was what, I mean, when Sloan knocked those problems down one after another, you know, part of it really was stopping this competition in the marketplace with its own divisions. You know, there was an obligation to share technology. That was part of it. And they were going to apply the same standard to evaluating R&D and new projects and capital across the division. So this is the process we're going to use, guys. We are not going to deviate from this. And if we decide that this is something worth green lighting at the Buick division, the Chevy division had to go through the same exercise. That took a while, but that was part of it as well. And they were like products, right? The marketplace was the marketplace and had like products. So that's a little harder to do when there's, you know, a service business alongside a product business, for instance. But it's still obviously possible. It's what you guys do. So you can show people how to do that.
So it's interesting. Well, it's just interesting how almost the opposite it was of P&G and how they did it, right? They competed within and started in that model and then ultimately moved to category management, probably learning a little bit from GM.
Well, the problem with all bureaucracies, and this is a wonderful concept, comes from a sociologist named Merton, M-E-R-T-O-N. It's called goal displacement, where what becomes important is that we follow the process and that we have the right form filled out and that we've, you know, populated all the fields in the management deck. And we have lost sight of the goal of going through that process, lost sight of the goal of the result we wanted when we adopted that process. And that's where companies get into trouble. And GM became a shining example of that, mm-hmm. where the bureaucracy needed what the bureaucracy needed, irrespective of the result it wanted in the marketplace. Decision-making slowed down. Entrepreneurial innovative people got in trouble for not following the right form. I know this guy, senior engineer at Medtronic, who got criticized for using the wrong font in his engineering reports. And that's a classic case of goal displacement. Who cares what the font looks like? If his work is good. He was trying to solve a problem in one of their drug pump businesses. And I don't know why he turned in a report with the wrong MS Word font, but he did. And it's like that, I mean, that's just a classic example of that. You know, and the entrepreneurial companies, I think Medtronic has been through some of these pains where, you know, where the bureaucracy or the processes become more important than the result you're going after. And they've worked on it. They've tried to pare it back. You know, Medtronic's a huge global company. You know, you'd expect some of that. But that's the thing that I think people realized when companies get in trouble, this problem of goal displacement was throughout the organization and it's just stifling. we're going to fill out this form because we filled it out this way every fiscal year since 1996.
Right.
And it's like, okay, great. You know, what are we, what, yeah, so what's you've got it.
No, meaning like, what does it do?
Yeah.
Nobody knows. Nobody can tell you.
Nobody knows. Nobody right. knows. Yeah.
The TPS report.
Right. And what, you know, this is, the military is a great example. There's no bureaucracy in the world like the U.S. Army, right? You know, but it does kind of work. Because if you're going to drop 24,000 people in Afghanistan and supply them from Florida, you better know how to, a bunch of things. You know, you got to have a process for getting toilet paper into Afghanistan. I understand that. But that, you know, the DOD has been, you know, battling that since, you know, the 1940s, you know, but, and it's a problem that it's both a strength and a problem. You know, the bureaucracy is one of the DOD is just, you know, I've read about that and it's just astounding, you know, but on the other hand, when they need to get the 82nd Airborne Division, you know, overseas, they know how to do it. And it does happen without a lot of individual, you know, invent stuff on the fly processes. They just know how to do it. So, I mean, I guess that's the upside of these things.
Do you think there's kind of a law of diminishing return almost, where the longer an organization has great processes in place, the more and more their managers lose sight of the core underlying economics?
I think you're onto something. I mean, that'd be something I'd have to explore with people, but yeah, I think that's part of it. And that, you know, that's why you see restructurings, you know. I've in Target's hometown, and a few years ago when they went through a painful period when a bunch of people got, you know, asked to leave, that was a case where whole teams were asked to leave. That was not a case where we're going to take a 10-person team to an 8-person team because we can't afford to pay them. That was not the thinking. The thinking was we need to eliminate this team to speed things up. And so the team that got eliminated might have been, you know, filled with people who were just as smart as a team that stayed, right? That was a really interesting exercise and obviously very painful organizationally. And Target had this term, I think they call them pyramids, you know, the organizational pyramids, which is, of course, the very definition of a bureaucracy, right? You know, you've got all these people on the bottom doing the work, and then they report to a manager who reports to a director who reports to a vice president who reports to an executive vice president who reports to a managing director who reports to the CI something or other in the C-suite. And I don't know, there could be 11 layers in there.
I was talking to a Target employee last night, and he used the pyramid.
Yeah. And so, you know, I do understand how we have that structure where, you know, or manager and the span of control and all that sort of stuff. But it really is important to keep an organization, you know, flat, because getting information from the front line all the way up to the general and back, you know, in 24 hours is enormously difficult the longer that message has to travel and the more people it has to go through. And that's also one of the issues that, you know, again, that in effective bureaucracies, where there really is empowerment for people to do some stuff within their defined spheres. Right? I can't commit the corporation to a $500 million project on my own authority, but I have the ability to act and move. And, you know, before Wells Fargo spectacularly blown up, that was always characterized as one of its strengths, right? You know, run it like you own it. You know, that culture went off the rails, but that was one of the ways they tried to deal with being this massive national bank with people and staff and business units all over the place, is that we wanted people to feel empowered to make decisions in their businesses within the parameters that we've set up for them. It went off the rails and needed to be fixed, but that was part of what they were known for.
One of the things that's interesting that you kind of brought up earlier, tying in two things together, is the checkbook, right? Like you look at, and I experienced this when I was at US Bank, you're in that hierarchy and that's your world, right? Mm-hmm. And you might understand the P&L you're given, but, you know, people struggle mightily when they actually have a real checkbook, right? And they have to manage that. And it looks very different than the process of a Target for a smaller company. Because Target, you know, the financing arm is almost independent from the rest of the operation. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about, you know, can we make payroll in 2 months if these things don't happen? And I always, so it's been a huge learning for me just having to kind of figure that out. With few mistakes, but it's a totally different world. I mean, it's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people who work at a corporation who then go become entrepreneurs, that's one of the big things they have to figure out, you know, because it's not like I can't get legal on the phone because that person isn't there. You know, it's just like you are unhinged from cash inside as a line manager in some of these organizations. You really are unhinged from it altogether. You know, there was a client doing that back when I was a consultant who was an operating unit of a bigger organization, but it was trying to develop something new, right? It was an entrepreneur or whatever that term is, where you have an innovative team, you know. And I finally recommended they'd be much better off if they put $5 million in a checking account and empowered, you know, Matthew to run it. And when the money was gone, the money was gone, and you had to send everybody home. Because when the parent organization had so much money that if 2 quarters went by and we didn't make as much progress as we needed to and the cash burn didn't fall as our annual plan said it would, there was just an expectation that there'd be more money next quarter and the quarter after that. And the decision to continue or not would have been made some strategic analysis or politics going on over my head. Well, that was unhealthy. I mean, because the money didn't seem real.
Right.
Every 2 weeks, we got money on our checking accounts. You know, we got a little 401k match. We're in this fabulous benefit program. We, you know, the nicest Herman Miller chairs on the market that we sit on. It's just none of it seemed real. And that was unhealthy, I think, for everybody involved. And then finally, I think they did adopt some version of that where, okay, this is the money you have. You're not getting any more. So let's see if you can get a product into the marketplace and develop positive cash flow. And I think that's ultimately what they did.
Yeah. The ultimate hatchet for discipline.
Right.
You run out of money.
You run out of money.
Don't spend it.
It does kind of sober you up, right?
Yeah.
You
know,
right. Yeah, my entrepreneurial background is a little itty bitty consultancy, but I absolutely knew what our money situation was, and because I didn't want to get to payroll, I had to go over to the payroll provider on Wednesday to get paid on Friday, and I didn't want to have to call the bank on Wednesday afternoon to advance money on my personally guaranteed credit line. Mm-hmm. I just didn't want to have to do that because if I do that Wednesday, then what if I do if it's a bigger number 2 weeks later? How much longer do I want to have a personally guaranteed credit line do that? Absolutely right. Focused me.
Yeah, so. They say that a pending loss is 2 to 3 times more motivating than a gain.
Right. Yeah. But some, you know, I love some of these stories of the old days in business because we do have this perception that we've invented stuff in our lifetime. Look at this clever stuff we now do. We can do all this financial analysis right on an iPhone, you know, seated in the backyard. Well, there's been a lot of sophisticated stuff that's been around for a long time. Smart people figured this stuff out. And that's kind of why I like looking at some of the economic history, you know, particularly from the late 19th century and the industrial age through kind of yesterday. You know, Steve Jobs didn't come out of nowhere. They learned how to do stuff that other people had already figured out. I've read extensively about, you know, some of the people, you know, going back in these industries, but as we think about them, they're old and stodgy and hidebound or traditional. They weren't that way when they got going, you know, and somebody figured it out. And the more creative, entrepreneurial, inspirational guys went out of business along the way.
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. Like if you try to put your 1920s glasses on and you say, yeah, General Motors became what it became. Like, I mean, it was larger than most countries, right?
And yeah.
I mean, that was, I can hardly fathom that now. I mean, I could imagine fathoming that with out modern interstates.
Which kind of makes the achievement of Musk and Tesla, you know, pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. And that's not a normal guy. You can tell that, you know, capital, it's capital intensive business. You know, capital has been very much part of their whole story. Now that they've got this equity value that's so high, making their capital so cheap, your equity's worth a lot, sell it to somebody. Raise some money, you know? And obviously they've done that. So yeah, he's the most interesting figure maybe in my lifetime. I wouldn't want to work for him or I wouldn't want to be his neighbor. But
maybe his lawyer.
And maybe his lawyer, yeah. Lawyer, what a fascinating figure. Wouldn't want to be his PR guy.
That's why I didn't want to run his Twitter account.
Yeah. No, what the hell did you do, you know? But there's also, I mean, there's discipline there too. Organizational discipline and how they used the money and what they had to achieve to get more money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I've seen interviews. He gets very adamant about the role of capital allocation and how that's, you know, the pinnacle of the role for him. Like he realizes that that's what he needs to do as a CEO. So
that whole gift of what deserves capital, I mean, that's what Wall Street used to be good at. Wall Street banks were all clubs, essentially. But they used to be really good at that. Then the investment banks kind of abdicated that role. They became corporations and their money wasn't on the line anymore. And they sold whatever gets they could sell, whether it worked out or not. What the hell do they care if this bond issue didn't work out? You know, I didn't have my money on it. And to some extent, that has gone to the VCs, to the private equity guys. But even that's a little bit of an agency principle. And so the real masters of capital allocation, I think, are the corporate guys. You know, Buffett is a version of that. But, you know, even Target comes out of a rich, rich tradition of ROIC analysis. And that got put in place by the old Dayton Hudson, the Dayton brothers, who were in a multi-divisional situation where they needed to bring a discipline across the organization. For a long time, that annual report would have a big section on ROIC and how they evaluated and ran the business. And that was a business with all these sort of inspirational merchants, right? 10 middle-aged men would argue lipstick shades. You know, it was presumed to be intuitive. You know, we know what the customer wants. And they established a discipline around that. I'm 100% convinced that when Walmart rolled out of Arkansas and ate the whole industry, except for Target, that is why. It was that discipline. It was that tradition that existed inside that organization. And then, of course, Amazon blew up into a big deal and Target is still hung in there. So that'd be a case study worth thinking about, worth rolling.
Oh, and we'll do that one next.
You'd have to talk to somebody who knows where that came from. I think it was Ken Dayton. I get the brothers confused. Mm-hmm. They were all before my time a little bit. They were still alive, you know, in my lifetime, but they were no longer active in the business. But I think he tried to figure out there's got to be a way to rationalize and run this business. And they did it, you know, are we going to invest in our Target business? Or are we invest in our department store? Or we put everybody in use the same yardstick. And they still do that. You can still listen to those folks talk about return on invested capital. And are we going to invest in our store? Are we going to invest in our distribution capability for online? This is the way we're going to go about. This is the methodology and the discipline we're going to go about doing that. So, you know, it's all over the place. We really do see it all over the place. And I'd say on balance, Target's a really well-managed company. You know, it would have to be if you did right now.
Well, I think we're getting up to the end of the hour. So if there's anything else anybody wants to throw out there, do that now. But
I might have talked too much. Sorry, guys.
That's great.
Yeah.
No,
that's
like,
great.
If you got more, keep going. No, this is the thing, Lee. Like you know, when we can talk about this in normal, accessible terms, then I actually get to participate. That's one thing. That's nice. And then we've got so much, you know, here that I don't, you know, we're still trying to make sure that everyday business person, you know, can get their head around this and that they can understand how this really applies to your business, right? And, you know, I'll speak for myself, you know, not until I started understanding these basic principles and not until I really started owning up to the kind of things that Kevin was talking about, like the need for me to be responsible for return. That's when things really started, you know, moving for me in my career and when I started seeing more results in what I, you know, did in my day-to-day work. So, you know, hopefully more people will start understanding this concept and we're going to start from the top down with the business owners in the middle market. But you've been helpful. This is great. You know, we always like talking with you. So thanks for spending some time with us today.
This was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Good.
All right, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks for listening. To hear all past episodes and read the episode summaries, which includes any links mentioned in the episode, as well as full show notes, head on over to forwardlookingbusiness.com. There, you'll also be able to schedule a call with our capital director to see how we can help your company meet its capital allocation needs.